The Wintrust Business Lunch with Aki Ito, Chief Correspondent at BusinessInsider.com. Aki, welcome back.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Interesting story today, headlined, "It's Hard to Find a High Salary Job." You say the price point above which it can be very difficult is, say, six figures. If you had a job or are looking for one that pays north of $96,000, those jobs are harder to find right now. Is that it?
Yeah, that's right. So the hiring rate for those high earners has dropped a lot since its peak in the middle of 2022. And it's interesting because the hiring rate for people who are earning a lot less, who are earning less than $55,000 a year, has continued to hold up really well, really well. And so we're seeing this like really strange bifurcation of the job market right now, where for most workers, things are looking pretty good. But just for the elite white-collar professionals, things are starting to take a pretty bad turn.
And I think some of our listeners would say, well, $96,000 isn't really elite pay these days, depending on where you are in your life. You got kids, you got cars, you got a dog, you got a house. $96,000 isn't what it used to be. And yet above that, the hiring rate has really dropped off precipitously. I think about the employment and unemployment rates these days, and we know that unemployment is very low, employment is very high, but we also know that a lot of people are working more than one job, one and a half jobs or two jobs, and it may be because of what you're pointing out here, that the jobs that are out there are $50,000 jobs, they're not $100,000 jobs.
Yeah, yeah, I'm hearing from a lot of my readers, you know, who used to have these jobs, you know, that pay very well, that they're just not able to find the next one. So I've actually heard from a number of them, even since this story ran, that they've had to take on lower paid jobs. For example, they're, you know, trying to make ends meet by being an Uber driver, for example. Lots of stories of, you know, how there aren't that many like well-paying jobs anymore.
Yeah, it might be you have a job and then you've got a side hustle. You know, you've got something else you're doing to bring in more income. But about the economy overall, did you invent the word vibe session?
No, it wasn't. I believe it was Kyla Scanlon, who's a blogger and speaks a lot about the economy. I think she was kind of trying to get at this sense that, you know, it just feels like a recession, even though all of the, you know, major economic indicators that we typically rely on show that we're not even close to a recession. The economy is, you know, is at least according to these statistics, doing really well. But we kind of have this sense that it's not going well. You know, when you just talk to like kind of ordinary people out on the street, a lot of people actually assume that we're already in the recession. And it's interesting that there's this, you know, real dichotomy between like how people feel it is versus, you know, what the economic statistics actually show.
Yeah. And I don't think there's any talking people into feeling better about the economy. It's not their job to make you feel better about the economy. If inflation is high, if they can't get out of the house or buy a house because the interest rates are too high, then that's very real, even though technically, right, it's not a recession, is it?
Right. So, you know, there's factors that you mentioned, inflation, interest rates, those are, you know, certainly factors that I think factor into this as well. But, you know, the one I talk about in my story is the sense that because the hiring rate for higher earners has plunged so much, you know, people feel kind of trapped in their current jobs. You know, most people who want a job have a job right now. The unemployment rate is very low. But, you know, if you really hate the job that you're in at the moment, you feel like you can't quit because there no one else is hiring right now. My colleague Emily Stewart called this the trapped in place economy. And I think that, you know, kind of captures the feeling that a lot of white collar professionals have right now, because, you know, maybe like 2 years ago, it was really easy for them to jump ship, find a new job. You know, something doesn't go right in their job and they can just go to the next one. But that's not the economy we have anymore. And it creates a lot of kind of, you know, like discontent, I guess, this like low morale in corporate America that I think we're going to see even more of if this low hiring continues over the next few years.
Aki Ito's chief correspondent at Business Insider. It's hard to find a high salary job, she writes, at businessinsider.com. Nice to talk to you, Aki. Thanks for your help today.
Oh, of course. It's always great to be on your show.
The Wintrust Business Lunch. Philip Weiss joins us regularly on the Business Lunch. He's the president of SciFarth at Work. The EEOC has issued new guidance for employers, I guess. Philip, you follow this. What's the latest on that?
Yeah, the latest is it's sort of monumental if you think about it historically. The last time the federal EEOC issued comprehensive guidance, kind of soup to nuts rules related to workplace harassment, which is what we're focused on here, was back in 1999. So we're talking a quarter of a century ago, and they've let out different rules and guidance and drips and drafts since then. But as of last week, employers are well advised to check out the EEOC's website and see what this kind of comprehensive, consolidated set of rules looks like. And there's a lot of interesting rules to follow. One that is kind of eye-opening is what I would refer to as the collateral damage rule under harassment law, which is one of these focus areas. And that is, John, it's not only the people that you maybe intended to target or who were the targeted victims of harassment that can sue, it's others. People that get affected by harassment and misconduct, even though that was never the perpetrator's intent. So that's something that employers should be thinking about.
So give me an example of that. I can understand how if I'm harassed, I have a case. Talk to me about this environment. Tell me what that looks like.
Yeah, that's the key. Like, what is collateral damage? Who are these people that can sue and possibly win when, in fact, there was no intent as far as they were concerned? So one really good example, John, is a manager, let's say in a sales company, and we saw this with a real estate firm that came to us for some consulting help, just sort of is musing about who would be an effective closer on real estate deals and talks to people close to him about one cultural group, one ancestry group, and says, I'd love to use these people to close my deals, but I just sense that given their background, given their culture, they're perhaps a little less motivated, maybe even a bit lazy. No one in the group that he was referring to was present. But as always happens, the word got out, and these people who were members of this group got wind of the comments. Under the guidance and under current judges' rulings, that group could sue. It doesn't matter that they were there. It doesn't matter that he meant them to hear it or not. It's the fact that they're part of the work environment and they were offended. So that's one interesting example. And briefly, another good one that doesn't relate to people being out of earshot has to do with individuals who are kind of roped in to engaging in harassment. So we have another company, an ambulance services company out of Illinois, where the branch or station manager went a little bit rogue. And because he didn't like people of a certain faith, he told his dispatchers, hey, I'd like you to schedule them for work on the ambulance rigs very close to when their holidays begin and end, making it difficult for this group to get back and forth and perform their rituals and perform their work on time. Well, not only were the people who were targeted able to sue, so were the people who we compelled to make the scheduling decisions. So people that were not of the faith were not affected, but were roped in. They were the collateral damage victims in this case. So it's not about the intended victim. It's about the others at work as well.
I'm thinking about, and maybe this is a little dated, but employers or places of employment where it's very touchy-feely, where the boss is kind of a hands-on hugger, grabber, kisser, pincher, squeezer. And I think we all got the memo that we don't do that anymore. We shouldn't have done it at all. But even if you weren't pitched or hugged or squeezed or kissed on the cheek, that can be an unpleasant environment. Do you think that would fall into this category?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really a great example because there are many environments, John, where some employees have been there for decades. And in fact, that is what they are used to. Mm-hmm. They may not object to it or believe they object to it because, you know, who knows underneath how they really feel, but from what we understand. But other employees come and go, transferred in. They see that this is the expected norm, the hug, the warm pat on the back that lasts more than 4 seconds. And to them, that's not only irksome, it's a little creepy, and they wonder, do I have to engage in that with the manager or others to be fully accepted here? So this is why the laws actually make good sense, even though they may take some getting used to by everybody. We appreciate that, but we have to appreciate the lines need to be consistently applied.
New EEOC guidelines, first time you remind us since 1999, so 25 years in the making. Collateral damage is one of them, and Philip Weiss is happy to tell you all about it. He's the president of SyfarthAtWork.com. Nice to talk to you, Philip. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, John. Take care.
Dennis Rodkin, the senior reporter covering residential real estate for Cranes, joins us. He's here in the studio again today. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, John. How are you?
Pretty good. Lingering over the whole real estate world has been these agreements that we have with the buying agent and the selling agent. What's the latest on that?
It will now be required as of mid-August. We learned on Friday that any buyer, before you go out and look at homes with a real estate agent, you will need to sign a buyer broker agreement. This comes from all the lawsuits and the other drama over the past few years about how brokers are compensated. The standard has been in the past, in really for most of the past century, that the buyer pays the seller for the house. Out of those proceeds, the seller pays the seller's agent, who out of that pays the buyer's agent. This appears to a lot of people to be collusion and price fixing. So there have been all these lawsuits. There have been several pieces of this that have turned recently. The National Association of Realtors on Friday announced from now on, or from August 17th on, buyers will have to sign an agreement with a broker saying, I understand that you need to get compensated, and there will be details about how the compensation happens. All of that will be laid out in advance before you ever go to look at houses. That hasn't been true before. A lot of agents, some brokers, some brokerages have recommended that agents have a buyer-broker agreement. Sometimes it's a little informal. Sometimes it's on paper. But as of mid-August, you will be signing that piece of paper before you ever go check out that condo in Andersonville.
Is the compensation schedule the same for all realtors or agents, or does it depend? They can put in there whatever they want. They just have to disclose that to you.
This is still evolving. I think by August 17th, we'll have a more complete answer to that. As of now, essentially what you need to say is, I, the buyer, understand that you need to get you, my agent, need to get compensated. I think there will be far more detail in that agreement by the time it actually becomes official in August. The problem here was that because of that sort of boomerang of fees that I was describing, people got the impression, and some people actively promoted the impression, that for a buyer there was no cost. That let's just go look at some houses, and it doesn't cost you anything to get in my car and drive. I'm the buyer's agent, to get in my car and drive around and look at these things because you're not paying a cent. That was the impression. And again, in some cases, there were agents who actually pushed that. So what's trying to be made very clear now is that is not true. The buyer's broker will be paid. The question we still have is, will it be through that same structure as happened before? Will I negotiate a fee with, I, a buyer, negotiate a fee with my agent, or what? We still have several months of work when all of that will develop.
Well, it was and still is true that you can get in the buyer's agent's car and drive around and look at houses. They don't run a meter on you.
Right.
And you may never buy a house from that person, and they never get compensated. And that won't change. That will still be the case.
It is still true.
Unless they're going to charge you, unless you sign a thing that says you got to pay me $1,000 just for me showing you houses.
And somewhere over the course of the next few years, it could be that buyer brokers charge a flat fee. We don't know yet.
Yeah.
It still could be true that you would sign that agreement saying, yes, I understand that you, the buyer broker, have to get compensated, And still, I would just drive around with you, look at a bunch of houses and say, okay, see you later, and go deal with somebody else.
Well, I don't know how else it's going to happen. I mean, if you are going to engage a buying agent, they got to drive you around and show you houses. And you're only going to buy the house you want. If you don't find one, then you don't buy one.
Well, the primary difference here is in the time sequence. Rather than going around and looking at things and then decide and then signing with this agent, you will sign an agreement with the agent, not necessarily an exclusive one, not necessarily one saying, I will buy through you, but one, before we ever go look at properties, I'll sign saying, if I work with you, I understand that in one way or another, I'm on the hook for your compensation.
Well, were I to sign one today, it would say, okay, you are my agent. We're going to drive around and look at houses. If we buy a house, the sellers are going to pay their agent 6%. 3% is going to come to the buyer's side. Each of those agents will have to kick a lot of that money to the agency itself.
To the brokerage, right.
And then pay their people. So ain't nobody getting rich here, Williams. But at least... That's the way it works. And I thought that the idea was now that maybe we will just tell the buyer's agent straight up, the seller can take their 3, but I'm only going to pay you X. I'm just going to give you what I think this is worth. And that'll be something you and I negotiate.
Absolutely. First of all, let's be clear that 3% and 6%, that's not the rule. That's very common, but it's not the requirement. Most often it's 3% and 2-3% for a 6% commission.
Or 5, 2.5, yeah.
Yes, it is. It's also very likely that the buyer will deal directly with the buyer's agent, pay compensation. It might be a flat fee. That's one of the reasons these lawsuits happened, is that buyer brokers were saying, now that you're shopping for homes on the internet, you don't have to wait to come to my office and see the box of index cards on my desk that list all the properties. You can do a lot of most of the pre-shopping on your own. Buyer brokers were saying, I should be able to compete on price. I should be able to say, I'm going to make up these numbers. For $100, I'll show you 2 properties, or whatever it would be.
Wow.
I should be able to say,
really?
Charge me a flat fee. Attorney's fees are a flat fee. I should be able to do that.
Well, those better be good properties. Okay,
well, yeah.
But then comment on this. In a lot of instances, I buy a $500,000 house, and that throws off $30,000 worth of fees. And I think a lot of us have been in that equation and thought, I don't know, $30,000 strikes me as a lot of money. That seems to be a lot of money. Sometimes for deals that in the market the last couple of years, the house turns in a week.
That's another reason.
Boom.
That is another reason that people are saying we really probably shouldn't be paying this level of commission. So again, the seller's agent is doing things like, you know, staging the place, getting all your shaggy old furniture out, making it look really good, marketing it, making a marketing plan, getting it not only in the MLS but in postcards and whatever else, holding open houses. So it's easy to see that the selling agent is working really hard. But as you say, a buyer's agent, especially now that the buyer's agent doesn't have that box of file cards, here's one on Main Street, let's go look at it. You've already, on the internet, found the one on Main Street and 5 more down on Elm Street and Maple Street. You don't really need me, the buyer's agent, to do that. So the question is, how much work is a buyer's agent doing?
Yeah.
How much should you pay?
Yeah.
And so one of the things we might see, but again, this is all evolving, we might see buyer brokers charging flat fees. For this amount, I'll show you some properties. For this amount, I'll do a price evaluation for you. For this amount, I'll hold your hand all the way through the process.
Maybe so. I can only speak from personal experience, although we all talk to people about their homes and the process of getting in and out of them. And there are instances where my agent or the other agent really worked hard. It was a complicated deal, or it was hard to find or hard to get to a price point, and they earned thousands of dollars. And there are other times where you thought, wow, I'm handing you a check and I did most of the work. And then you resent that. And I don't know how a app or a schedule is going to discern, you know, or anticipate which was which. But I guess that's the new world.
I'll tell you, John, there's the president of a Chicago brokerage told me, I'm going to use non-gender pronouns to keep from revealing anything, told me that they feel that this will actually be a good thing because it will weed out those buyer brokers who really kind of pick up their feet and say, I don't really have to do anything. I'm just going to ride along through the sale and collect a commission, and that what they really want to see is buyer brokers who are doing the kind of work you're describing, who are steering me away from properties that really don't work for me, who are checking the inspections, the radon, and all that sort of thing.
And some houses just sell themselves because it's a great house in a great market, and there aren't many on the market.
Right.
Dennis Rodkin is here. He is the senior reporter covering residential real estate at Crain's Chicago Business. ChicagoBusiness.com is their website. I wanted to talk to you about a compact luxury home development. Think about those words, compact luxury home development. First, let's update you on more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Teen retail chain Rue 21 has declared bankruptcy and will close all 540 of its stores, including 20 in Illinois. The chain also has stores in Northwest Indiana and Wisconsin. The Pennsylvania-based chain tried to sell the business but was unable to find a buyer. Stores will start their going out of business sales in about a month. Rue 21's area stores are in Aurora, Gurnee, Calumet City, North Riverside, Lincolnwood, McChesney Park, Schaumburg, Chicago Ridge, Waukegan, Cicero, Merrillville, and Michigan City. An auction will reportedly happen Friday for assets belonging to the shuttered Foxtrot grocery stores. Crain's reports the online auction will include inventory, intellectual property, equipment, and other items. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank will run the auction. Foxtrot is a Chase debtor. It's unclear whether the store's sister retailer, Dom's Kitchen and Market, will be part of the auction. Dom's wasn't mentioned in the auction announcement. Neither was the parent company, Outfox Hospitality. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
All right, now the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And one of the fun things about doing the business of food is hearing origin stories from businesses that started out in home kitchens.
I would put my kids to sleep around 9 or 10 p.m., and I would bake until 2 or 3 in the morning, only to get up again at 6 a.m.
Who she is and more of her sweet story after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us. There has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. I wonder how many teachers standing in front of their classes dream of doing something else. These two did.
My name is Samaya Vahora.
And my name is Humaira Rofe.
They taught at the same school.
And I told Humaira about my dream.
To open a bakery.
She believed in the dream, so we're like, okay, let's just team up.
And the dream wasn't just a bakery. It was a vehicle to help people who need a hand.
And that was the biggest thing for me. It was that, you know, we need to empower women who are in times of difficulty, who were trying to get back into the workplace.
Sweet Reserve Bakery was born right in the middle of the pandemic. Yeah, there were doubters.
Yeah, they're like, you don't know what you're doing. Are you out of your mind?
But they found a way. Cake jars.
It's basically a cake in a jar. So if there was a birthday party, someone would order 50 cake jars and just go and deliver to all their friends and family instead of having an actual event.
Those jars kept them going.
We were doing extremely, extremely well.
And still are, thanks to a multicultural twist on baking.
I'm from India. My partner, Humaira, she's from Pakistan. So we came up with a lot of like fusion desserts. And I think the biggest thing, every single item we make is made from scratch.
The Sweet Reserve Bakery in Lombard has gone over so well, a new one is opening Friday in Skokie.
4845 Oakton Street, Skokie.
The Wingding is at 3 on Friday, and more locations are in the works for this year. And staying true to one of the reasons they're in business, a 501c3 is coming soon, the Sweet Reserve Foundation, to continue giving back, including to where it started for them. Education.
The teacher from the CPS asked us to create a fundraiser where she collected through us a couple $1,000s to get computers for her classroom.
Congratulations, ladies.
But thank you so much for the time. We really appreciate it.
On the food calendar, it's National Roast Leg of Lamb Day. Oh, and look at this, connected to what we've been talking about. It's National Teacher Appreciation Day. So, you know, maybe go over to the bakery and pick something up for your teacher today. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Dennis Rodkin is here. He's the real estate reporter over at Crain's. What's this? It struck me as a funny combination of words where it's a luxury. Where did I put it
compact
now?
Luxury.
Yeah, say that again.
Compact luxury. This is a really interesting development out in Harvard, which is about 77 miles from where we're sitting. A developer who has done a lot in affordable housing in New Mexico moves back to Chicago, and she's thinking about the idea that, like, a bunch of us would like to retire and live near each other. We're not first-time buyers. We want a nice house, but we want a small house. I don't want all those cheap materials that are in a a lot of new houses. So she has built one. She plans to build seven. Just put the first one on the market. Two-bedroom house, 1,100 square feet.
Hmm.
It's priced well above other new single-family homes in Harvard, but because she has wood siding rather than vinyl, tile in the bathroom rather than vinyl, nice cabinets, lighted crawl space so that your storage of, you know, whatever, your luggage, your Christmas tree, that kind of thing is all in nice sealed storage. It's a and the other thing is 1,100 square feet, small house, two bedrooms, on a third of an acre. The idea being you're probably going to, you might want to garden. The roof is metal and is pitched, so you might direct rainwater right into your garden. It's metal, so the water's cleaner. She's thought of all these things, and she thinks of them as small luxury homes. You can close it up and go off to Florida, Arizona, whatever it is, but live in this cluster with your friends.
1,100 square feet, what is she pricing the houses at?
They're about $320,000, which is considerably above a house of about twice the size nearby, new house. But again, it's these finishes, it's this large lot. It comes. She's planting 15 trees, including 6 fruit trees on the property. So the idea is that I might be willing to pay more. And one of the things she mentioned to me is, you're coming out of your nice house where you raised your kids, you spent a lot of money on it, you upgraded it, you made it look really good. You'd like to move into something like it, but small.
Comparable, but smaller. Boy, don't you roll your eyes sometimes at these big, beautiful houses and these big, beautiful new subdivisions, not a tree in sight. And you're thinking, you just spent $637,000. Plant a tree. Come on. Plant a tree.
Put in some flowers. And one of the things, that's one of the things that the agent on these talked about is, you know, there's so much room in those houses that you walk past and never really use.
Yeah.
The idea is we're probably an older married couple, might not be old, might be younger, but the idea is that they're largely for retired people. And we don't need a lot of space. We want a good footprint. We want a nice place, but we don't need bedrooms for a whole bunch of children and guests and whatever else. We don't need a formal dining room. We need a nice small place we can manage that isn't expensive to heat when we're gone in the winter.
So the firm is Family Villages. Is that what they're calling the development?
The name is not Family Village. The name of the development isn't, but the concept she has is Family Villages. She'd like to build more. If this one goes well, she would build more, either there in Harvard or in other locations. It's a really interesting idea because it's small houses. They're not tiny houses. They're not those little things that were popular a few years ago. They're small, they're nice, and the idea is out there in Harvard, you have a little bit of an arts community, you have lots of nature, you're not too far from Lake Geneva, you've got Metro to downtown. Once again, she's not only selling to retired people, but as a place to retire, it seems like a nice sort of a concept.
You mentioned the one house in your article is listed with Amy Dillenberg of Coldwell Banker Real Estate Group. $375 for the one in the article.
Right, $375. Sorry, I misspoke. That's the price.
You're in the neighborhood. Dennis Rodkin, senior reporter covering residential real estate over at Crain's. All the time we have today. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks, John.